Welcome to Gonkcast, an Autechr podcast. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this is a slightly different bonus episode from the ones we've done in the past because it's basically a continuation of our last episode on both of Warp's artificial intelligence compilations. As you may have noticed, we crammed as many listener emails into that episode as we could, and the episode was literally almost as long as both comps for that reason. But there were still more listener comments we decided to save for this episode, and even a handful of comments on the other albums in the artificial intelligence series, Warp's AI video album, etc., etc. So think of this episode like a DLC pack or something for our last episode. I should also mention that we're recording this pretty soon after our last episode. I'm just holding on to it before posting for a few days. So if you sent us an email recently and don't hear us discuss it here, don't worry, we will get to it. Before we get started, let me just remind you that our next proper episode a week from now will be the first in a multi-part series on Gescom. We'll be talking about both Gescom EPs, the sounds of machines our parents used, Keynel, and Motor. So if you've got thoughts on any of those, send them our way, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. We'll get to the rest of Gescom in the bonus episodes and one more proper episode over the next few weeks. So if you've got thoughts on any other Gescom releases, you can start sending those in now as well. Again, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. All right, Dan, the main thing I want to do today is spend a little time on the other albums from the Artificial Intelligence series, which included the first Artificial Intelligence comp in 1992, Surfing on Sine Waves by Polygon Window, aka Richard D. James, Bites by Black Dog Productions, Electrosoma by B12, Dimension Intrusion by Fuse, aka Richie Houghton, Ginger by Speedy J, Incunabula by Autechr, all of those are from 1993, by the way, and the second Artificial Intelligence comp from 1994. We talked about the two comps, of course, and we've already devoted an entire episode, obviously, to Incunabula, but let's just walk through the other sort of lightning round style, not trying to do comprehensive reviews or anything, just some casual conversation. I should mention that we were inspired to do this after listener Joe shared thoughts on every album in the series. So you want to read his thoughts on Polygon Windows Surfing on Sine Waves first, Dan?
Sure. Joe writes, "For whatever reason, Surfing on Sine Waves was an album that never connected with me until I listened again to get ready for your episode, and I honestly have no idea what was wrong with me. It's so obviously a classic album and one of the highlights of the series, showcasing everything that would make RDJ amazing throughout his career. Although it doesn't quite reach the heights of Saw as an album, the music is just about as good. One thing that struck me is how much more RDJ seems to focus on tweaking the particular sounds of the synth while going with more stock rhythm sounds compared with Autechr on Incunabula."
Now, listener Steve said he's not the biggest fan of the title track here, and he added, "Apparently the entire Polygon Window album was an early demo submitted by Aphex to Warp, and Warp decided to release it once Aphex started taking off. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but maybe it's telling that it kind of sounds that way to him. What do you think about Surfing on Sine Waves, Dan?"
I like it. I think it's... pretty fairly rated, like on Rate Your Music's got a 3.49. I don't think it's the best of Richard D. James's work, but I think it's an interesting record. I've always sort of enjoyed it. It's the like other record of the Artificial Intelligence series besides, obviously Incunabula that I was most familiar with before doing this podcast. I've always liked it. I think it's much better than the other EP from, under the Polygon Window name, Quoth, however you say that. But yeah, I think it's an interesting record that showcase of the early talents of RDJ. I don't know if that demo thing is true or not, but, it's definitely interesting if it is.
Yeah. I mean... it kind of has that demo-ish sound to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't do like a bunch of digging. Basically, the investigation I did was to read the Wikipedia page, and it doesn't mention it. case closed. But it just has like this real gritty, like kind of dirtiness to it. It's like a surprisingly kind of aggressive acid techno sound for most of it. And I don't know. I've never been like a huge, huge fan of this album. For me, it's like, Richard D. James has these kind of two sides to him. One is kind of like wonky and, zany, like almost trolly in a way. Mm-hmm. And the other side is like shockingly tender and like a genius composer of melody, to the point where like reviewers often call melodies by other artists, Aphexian, you know, like that's how good he is. And this record is kind of like really heavy tilted on the like bonkers kind of blown out zany side for me. And you just get these light touches of the prettiness. Like If It Really Is Me has always been like a personal favorite of Richard D. James's output on this record. In fact, I would go so far as to say that one of my favorite things about Aphex Twin is that it can kind of turn on a dime. You know, you think like, oh, this is a joke song. You know, he's just like blasting our heads off with this. And then it just kind of like suddenly reveals this really gorgeous melody that only he could write. And you're just like, you know, knocked on your ass by it. Not that, you know, I like both sides pretty equally, but I've just always been a little disappointed by like how heavy this one leans on just like abrasive blasting bonkersness, you know?
Yeah, I understand that. And, you know, I think I appreciate that side more in RDJ, you know? Certainly I enjoy the other side too. But yeah, I think that's why I like this record, because it does sort of give you that bonkersness. I think, you know, speaking again to that like demo thing, I kind of like that it's like a little rougher around the edges than, you know, maybe some of his later works and stuff. Like, you know, I dig that kind of, you know, almost garage sort of, you know, demo-y feel to this record. You know, I don't think it's like the greatest electronic record ever or anything, you know, but I enjoy it. I think it's a cool look at his output, like from a way that maybe, you know, you don't always think of.
Yeah, I guess I agree with you on that, but I just sort of feel like on Selected Ambient Works, the kind of distortion and lo-fi quality, it's like distortion as texture, whereas here it's like distortion as distortion, you know? It's like actually like blowing your ears off sometimes fun, but sometimes annoying to me way. Now, listener Joe also wrote, you've talked a few times about the way that AE and RDJ listen to each other and play off of each other's ideas. Do you think Audaz Powder slowing down is a response to / inspired by the end of Crystal? There's a bunch of elements on the album in general that seem to have influenced the way that Incunabula and even Amber sound, but I think that most specifically UT1 Dot definitely influenced further, to the point where I wonder whether it's a straight up sample. I think that out of all of Aphex's albums, this had the biggest influence on early BOC and that particular mix of ambient synths and hip hop that characterized them. I can't imagine the Sanderson brothers never listened to this album. We don't have to get into these nitty gritty details on this, but do you think of Surfing on Sine Waves as like a particularly influential album among RDJ's output?
I'm sure it is, you know, among, you know, the people who've been around since that record, because he's right. I'm sure, you know, there's no way Boards of Canada, you know, didn't hear this record. You know, as to today, I don't know anymore. You know, I think it's definitely like eclipsed by, you know, both Saw Records and, you know, I Care Because You Do, you know, things like that, you know, that have the bigger name records, I think, have eclipsed it. But I mean, certainly, I think, you know, in, you know, 93, this definitely, you know, probably put out some waves.
Yeah. And I don't know about the like timing, you know, it is certainly striking coming off of AI1 and Crystal, and hearing that like almost iconic slowdown and then hearing kind of similar trick on Audaz Powder here. I don't know if the timing works or they could have been influencing each other, maybe just simultaneously stumbled on it. But, you know, to the point you just raised, the last thing I wanted to say about this is like, this is also kind of a really fun thing about Richard D. James. This isn't one of my favorite albums, as I said, but you just got to love, like, not necessarily the use of aliases, which is like a little over the top, as we talked about last episode, but just the way that everything about this record has this kind of hidden gem status. You know what I mean? It's like a different name. A lot of people probably didn't even know it was Richard D. James. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of, it almost teaches you right early on, like how it's going to be with Aphex Twin, which is like, you're going to do a lot of digging. You're going to like find weird aliases and stuff that may or may not be him. And we'll argue about it. And, you know, it's like half the fun, honestly, of being a fan. And it's kind of cool that like as early as 93, you're getting a big dose of that.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, as annoying as it gets, especially back in the iPod days, you know, there is a little, you know, bit of fun. I think it, you know, it goes along with that, you know, kind of a jokester quality that he has.
All right. Well, what did listener Joe have to say about Bites by Black Dog Productions?
Joe writes, Bites was the album that made me the saddest listening again. When I last listened to it, I remember it being one of my favorite electronic music albums of all time and just a generally mind-blowing experience all around. However, that was back decades ago when I was still a teenager, and now the music just sounds so dated, even compared with the other releases in this series. I might also be suffering from the same thing as Dan. Maybe I'm getting old. Thank you. but it's just too high energy for me from start to finish. I think it would still sound great in a club, and I still appreciate the way that tracks blend and melt in and out from one another. It's one I always recommend to people who are getting into early IDM and aren't too familiar with electronic music yet, but I honestly might stop doing that after listening to it closely for the first time in ages.
Yeah, we got into this a little bit right at the end of our last episode, but I'm kind of the exact opposite side of the spectrum as Joe here, where I, you know, hadn't listened to Bites in a while. I used to think it was cool, like it just wasn't one of my favorites or anything that really stuck out to me. And then revisiting it, you know, these past weeks, I was just kind of blown away by it. I think it's, you know, it's so obviously rooted in techno. So I understand like the comments about it being, you know, maybe a little dated sounding for listener Joe here and maybe others, but to me, it's almost like, you know how like techno and sort of early electronic music, it sort of comes from that minimalist tradition, like Terry Riley and that kind of like short repetitive loops, all sort of interlocking and interchanging. Mm-hmm. I feel like Bites, it like really, it just demonstrates that. Like it's so connected to those early roots where there are just lots of like really simple, you know, both percussive and melodic, you know, little motifs, but there's just so many all interlocking together. And on that note, I love how it's like there are so many different loops sort of all colliding and cascading all over the place. This thing sounds like overstuffed to the point where the record has this kind of gritty, like grainy, like they're pushing the recording equipment too far or something. And it gives it this almost plunderphonics quality, like where, you know, you're listening to the Avalanches or something and you're trying to make out individual samples, but it's too much of like a psychedelic blur. So you just can't. I get that same kind of like, I don't know, just mind-boggling experience from this record. But what do you think of Bites?
Yeah, I you know, hate to disagree with Joe so much, but I love this record. You know, I like Black Dog. You know, this isn't the record I go back to as much. You know, I you know, generally go to Spanners, obviously. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this was like such a great record to come back to. I agree with you. It's got so much of that, like, minimalism feel to it in this sort of, you know, early 90s, you know, techno sort of context, which I think is great. You know, I love all that, you know, sort of minimalist stuff. And also, I really don't think that this record sounds dated. You know, I mean, it definitely, like, you can tell it's from the 90s or whatever, but I don't think that in, like, it's more of in the sounds of the instruments rather than, I think, the, like, content of the record. You know, I think it still holds up today.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, like, the compositions are, like I said, I mean, they're so overstuffed. They're just endlessly dazzling to me, but it also has this kind of like, you know, overstuffed, like almost unquantized quality for me, where it's mm-hmm. like, it kind of reminds me of Autechre's more recent work, where it's like, you know, this kind of, there's this just like kind of tumbling chaos to a lot of the tracks. Like there's so much stuff going on that it's going to fly off the rails at any moment. And, I don't know. It's just like really, really inventive. Now I'll go ahead and read Joe's comments about Electrosoma by B12. Joe writes, Electrosoma has always been an underrated album, most likely because of B12's limited output. Although Time Tourist is awesome and has one of my all-time favorite album covers, I've always thought that out of all of the non-RDJ AE albums in the series, this is the standout. Thankfully, listening to it again just confirmed everything that I remember about it. They somehow managed to choose only synth and drum sounds that still sound good today, and the compositions and layering is perfect. The only downside is that out of all the albums in the series, you could argue that this is the most samey, or you could argue it's the most consistent, depending on if you have a glass half empty or full perspective. So what do you think about Electrosoma?
You know, this is a record I wasn't overly familiar with. And so, you know, in coming, you know, in getting preparing to do this podcast, I, you know, I was looking at it. I think the cover is like super cool looking. And then there's like a comment on Rate Your Music. It's like, this is perfect music for listening to Philip K. Dick, which is like one of my favorite artists and stuff. So I was like, this is going to be made for me. I also like Hall of Mirrors, Metropolis. So, you know, those seems like Kraftwerk references. So I was really excited to dig into this record. In fact, it was the first one I listened to, and I was kind of disappointed. It's okay. I don't think it's a bad record by any sense, but it just sort of was maybe the least memorable of the series, and just kind of, you know, samey, like Joe said in there. I hate to be so down on Joe today, but I really have the opposite feelings about Electrosoma and Bites than he does. I don't think this record stands up. It's just sort of okay at best.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised in doing some research to see that it's got this kind of almost unanimous reputation as being like a underrated gem, like a true classic of early electronic music that a lot of people overlook. And, I hadn't really spent much time with it before, and so I was just really excited to kind of spend some time with that. I too was like a little underwhelmed, like you were. I don't know, paradoxically, it seems like, for some reason to me, the embodiment of like the artificial intelligence ethos or something. You know, it has like this very, I don't know, clean, like sort of polished, futuristic sound. It's like, you know, it's just paradoxical because all of these different artists and sounds and approaches and styles and everything are all, you know, contained within the artificial intelligence series itself. But for some reason, when I think of artificial intelligence, I think of this kind of sound. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think I get what you're getting at. You know, it is sort of like a distillment of, the AI series. And oftentimes like that distillment isn't really what you end up wanting. You know, it becomes samey and all. It does seem like paradoxical because you would think that, it's everything that makes that great. But I think like really a lot of what makes it great is the diversity of all these artists and everything, and you really here are just kind of getting that same sort of thing the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, I do like it. It has that kind of, we talk about this with the Warp tapes, where it's like it feels like the kind of record that's not breaking a ton of new ground, but if it had come out in 92 or whatever, mm-hmm. it would almost like sum up the previous era like in a really neat way. And this record seems to just, it almost feels similar, where it like almost puts a capstone on 1993 or something, and it's like, this is kind of what music was like at this time, and it does it like really, really well. Now, the problem is that's always, just necessarily reductive when you do that, because you, again, are sort of erasing all the like interesting little nooks and crannies of the sound. But, it's weird because like we talked about how Artificial Intelligence 2 sounded like a little generic for 1994, and like, am I crazy? This record sounds like Artificial Intelligence 2 just done better.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it speaks to that, distillment kind of thing I was talking about. But yeah, I mean, if this was just AI 2, AI 2 would be better.
Yeah. All right. Well, keeping it moving to the next record in the series, what did listener Joe have to say about Dimension Intrusion by Fuse, a.k.a. Richie Hawtin, a.k.a. Plastic Man?
Yeah. Joe writes, Dimension Intrusion is yet another forgotten classic by another forgotten great musician who would go on to make more excellent forgotten music under his Plastic Man pseudonym. While RDJ went in completely different directions after Saw, I feel like Hawtin took the basic sound palette, song concept, and continued developing a more high-definition version of it, incorporating other forms of ambient or minimalist techno from that era. FU is an absolute banger, and if I were a DJ in a cool 90s club, I would play the crap out of that 12-inch. I love how there's a mix of more chill and more rhythmic songs, but that the overall atmosphere of the album is definitely meant for chilling out. I rate it pretty similarly to Electrosoma, but even though it's quite a bit longer, Dimension Intrusions is generally more interesting and has more varied types of songs.
Yeah, so you kind of hated Hawtin's Spiritual High from the first AI compilation, and I was kind of mixed because I think it's a perfectly nice track, but it just doesn't fit on AI1. But then some of our listeners seem to really like it, like listener Steve, who said, it's brilliantly composed, trancy, and creating this flying sensation with an awesome acid melody. Love it. So does Dimension Intrusion fare any better for you?
I mean, I didn't kind of hate that song. I really hated Spiritual High. And so, you know, because of that, this is the one I was sort of looking forward to the least. But I ended up liking it quite a bit. In fact, it's kind of infuriating that Spiritual High is on AI1 and not literally anything else from this record.
Anyone would be better. Anyone.
Any song on this record fits, I think, that compilation better, and just in general is a better song. I kind of really liked this record. It's got like this cool, you know, ambient techno feel kind of to it, but it's also got you know, some of that upbeatness that is in Spiritual High, of course, but I don't know, Spiritual High just seemed so like outdated and you know, not pushing the boundaries in any way. This seems like taking that same sort of idea and pushing it, you know, creating something new, which I think is the entire point of, you know, electronic listening music and the AI series in general. You know, this was like a great like Joe said, you know, it's got those upper moments, but it's also, you know, mostly for, you know, chilling out. This was like a great record to put on while reading and stuff, like at home, you know. It just, I feel like, perfectly embodied what Warp was aiming for with that series.
Yeah, I agree actually completely, because it does have that. In fact, the sound palette honestly feels like this really kind of hardcore techno sound, and you get a lot of that on like FU, like listener Joe shouted out, and a couple other tracks that have that like light up the dance floor in the early 90s kind of energy. And then it almost feels like he uses the same exact sound palette to just kind of explore the depths of the sound. It's surprisingly deep, and actually the vast majority of the record is quite like, I don't know, spacious and mellow and introspective kind of. But, you know, it always feels rooted to the dance floor. So in that sense, it really does, I agree, feel like a great contribution to the AI series, you know, almost embodying the ethos of the AI series, where it's like, this is fundamentally dance music, but like, what more can we do with it without being like too elitist about it? It's just like, how, you know, let's take dance music and just push it in new directions and see where it takes us. You know, it just kind of has that kind of free-willing spirit that I love, and a genuinely like inclusive aspect. We talked a lot about like the potentially problematic nature of the AI compilation being like, oh, this is, you know, intelligent music, you know, not saying that directly, but critics maybe putting a lot of that on it, but just having that kind of general vibe. Mm-hmm. And this is more like, hey, dance music is cool, but so is weirder stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think this record definitely is the one that sort of shows its roots, which again, I think makes Spiritual High even more infuriating, because that one is just, I feel like, solely the roots. Whereas like this record does such a great mix of, you know, taking those roots, adding to them, you know, creating a different new experience, where that song just was, I felt like the old experience. So it makes me hate that track even more.
Yeah, well, you might say though that like this, like Spiritual High kind of does what, like helps AI1 do what this record does so well, which is like it does have some like straight up bangers, and that it kind of, you know, makes the explorations of the like inner nooks and crannies of that sound more fun. So maybe like you needed some like actual rave up on AI1 to really draw the contrast. I don't know, just a possible defense. But I also wanted to read this from listener Joe, who writes, the longer repetitive tracks on this record make me think of something I'm not sure you've ever brought up before. Although FU and They Chicks, not sure how to pronounce that, are much shorter than some of the epic mega tracks from LSEC and NTS, I do think there is a connection between these kinds of early 90s minimalist tracks, where when listening, you have a hard time figuring out if the small variations you're hearing are just tricks your brain is playing, or if the music is actually subtly changing over time. You've mentioned many times the connection between Autechre's later mega tracks and ambient music, but I think that it's also applicable to this style as well. You know, I just wanted to bring this up because it's a good point, where this is actually, you know, sort of rooted in early electronic music, rooted as well, like back in minimalism, as we were talking about earlier. But that kind of that trick playing, like on your brain, where repetition as, you know, kind of making your mind wander, certainly rooted in dance music just as much as this kind of like quote unquote IDM stuff that follows. You know, ironically though, even though I think like Autechre really embraces that early on with like Tri Repete and stuff, the repetition as mind-boggling trick, by the time we get to like NTS, I feel like they are trying to push away from that. They're actually actively trying to escape it by making loops that never repeat, like different iterations, you know, designing generative software that creates like a slightly different, almost in a real, you know, acoustic music, played music kind of a vibe where like no iteration is quite the same. You know what I mean? It's almost like they're doing now the very opposite of what dance music was originally formulated to do.
Yeah, I mean they're definitely like playing, you know, they start with the original trick of like your brain doing it, and then I think, you know, yeah, the current stuff is more of the, you know, using you know, quote unquote regular instruments where you can never, you know, play the same thing, you know, exactly the same. That's how, you know, Ottegger gets that whole, you know, generative label and all that stuff, right, that's been slapped right on it. But yeah, it definitely is interesting how they you know, hit both ends of that spectrum.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, what did listener Joe, and shout out by the way to listener Joe, I didn't notice this somehow, but on Twitter he had sort of asked us in advance of our last episode, I guess we both missed this somehow, but he was like, are you guys doing the whole AI series or are you doing just the comps? And, you know, neither of us responded, so I guess he was like, better play it safe and listen to every single album and write in with comments about every single album. But it's awesome they did that, because now we have this like perfect structure for this this episode. But what did listener Joe have to say about Ginger by Speedy J?
Yeah, and for the record, Joe does way more work for this podcast than I do. So
yeah, so, always dependable.
Yeah. So thank you. But Joe writes, Ginger is the one album I always remember absolutely nothing about, and listening this time was like listening to it for the very first time all over again. It's interesting that this got released later on and before Incunabula, because the two of them seem to be the albums that do the most drum processing and use the least stock drum sounds. Do you think this is simply because we're already a bit later in 1993 and there's just been some more development when it comes to electronic music sound design? The album in general sounds great, but much less dated than I would assume it would. It's hard for me to believe that this came out just 3 months after Bites. You guys are the experts. That's debatable when it comes to sound design, but to my ears, it just sounds like the most developed of the entire series. This was truly the hidden gem of the series for me. All the tracks seem so fully developed, both in their construction and their sound design, and it takes everything that feels good about electronic music from this era and refines it so well. It feels forward-thinking, though not quite as much as Incunabula. I think that you could make a perfectly reasonable argument that it's the best front-to-back album of the series. I have to say, though, that even though I love D-Orbit as part of AI-1, it sounds weirdly out of place here and really like it was made in a different era and just tacked on to the end.
Yeah, I you know, I had never listened to this one before these past couple weeks, and I was really excited about it because of the strength of his contributions to both AI compilations, actually. I do think it's a pretty cool record. I mean, we sort of praised the, like, weirder sort of ambient, again, speaking about early electronic music, the more like, you know, modular synth sounding, like just kind of arpeggiating ripples that he did, like on that track Fill 3. And of course, here we get like a couple more fills, Fill 4, Fill 14, Fill 15. So I'd like to hear the other ones if he actually did compose those, but they serve as like nice kind of little breathers between more, you know, fully developed, like beat driven tracks. Yeah, I agree with Joe to an extent that it does sound quite forward thinking, but my hunch is that, I don't know, a lot of the beats on this record, they sound like sampled. Like, it just sounds like a lot more use of samples and stuff on this record, and that gives it this kind of like more like mid-90s to late 90s kind of sound to me. I think I mentioned on our last episode that, like, you know, some of like his track D-Orbit, like, almost I would have guessed it's like a 1995 or 1996 track, honestly, because it sounds very trip hop. It sounds very like chill out. It sounds like the next thing that was going to come after the sort of initial IDM explosion. So I got to give him credit for that. I mean, you know, in general, I find this record just kind of like relaxing and just kind of washes over me with a couple like really bright spots. Honestly, I think D-Orbit like works as a really nice coda because it's like kind of the best track here for me. So it's like a nice payoff at the end, but you know, not like a spectacular record for me, but like a really pleasant experience. How did you feel?
I think I'm back to agreeing with Joe a little bit. I liked this record. It was brand new to me as well. This one, for God knows why, isn't on Spotify or anything.
Right.
You know, and even going on Rate Your Music, it's only rated 3.39, which is sort of low, even though it has like much less ratings than a lot of these records. You know, so I wasn't like particularly looking forward to it or anything. And it was honestly the last one I did listen to. But I ended up liking it. I think the ambientness of it was really cool. I like those fill, you know, little breather tracks in there. You know, it's got a bit of that, you know, West Coast, you know, Buchla sort of feeling to it and all, which I like. I kind of agree that D-Orbit sounds a little tacked on, especially being at the end there. I don't know. It just felt like sort of a rave up at the end of this record, which isn't like really a record that needed to like give you a boost of energy at the end. You know, I was sort of, I thought it like worked so well. Like I listened to it in bed, reading, and it was, you know, just D-Orbit sort of like wasn't the greatest way to end the sort of mood it was putting on. You know, I don't think it's the best of the series or anything, but it was definitely like, a pleasant surprise, of a record, I think.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's, yeah, I guess, you know, we're maybe sort of disagreeing, but it's like we both liked it. Not to say I kind of feel that way about this whole series. Like, no matter what, you know, denigrating things it may sound like we're saying, like, this is like really a strong series.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's almost the whole series. And in lieu of talking about Incunabula again, there were a few AE-related comments that I couldn't quite fit into the last episode. First, from listener Jordan, who writes, I think the jump from the groovy beats of the Warp Tapes and the music of Incunabula is down to the Artificial Intelligence series, a series made by Warp to exhibit the depths of where electronic music can go. I think a light bulb went off in Rob and Sean's heads, and they thought, this is where we go now. The idea of post-rave electronic music, not just for the body, but for the brain, that clicked with them both. I think I brought this up actually on our last listener email episode, but having gone through the entire AI series, what do you think about the idea that Autechre kind of, you know, found themselves through their participation in this project?
I mean, I think it's, you know, definitely likely. You know, you listen to Cavity Job, you know, and it just sounds miles away from this. You know, the Warp Tapes, I think, you know, seem, I mean, obviously, you know, part of it is on AI, but, you know, it's definitely like closer in this direction. But I think, like, you know, Incunabula and stuff is such a leap forward. It really does sort of seem like they found a, you know, this group of people and this place that could support like the crazy ideas they would come up with and everything. And, you know, maybe even hanging out with or working with these people, you know, sort of, I don't know, like gave them that creative boost to move that way. You know, it definitely feels like the you know, maybe the biggest thing we get from the AI series is this like idea of Autechre. You know, like it creates like what we know of as Autechre today.
Yeah, I agree. And I think like the simple reason is that the idea of electronic listening music is super liberating, you know, because like, think about it this way. Like, you can make a banger for home listening, and you can make like weird abstract, you know, sound sculptures for home listening. But the club has more specific rules, right? Like it has to bang. You
yeah,
know? And
of course.
Maybe some people would probably disagree with me on that and say that, oh, there's plenty of producers who are like really pushing the limits of what you can actually dance to, and like, fair enough, but there's still like some sort of weird structures. And I just think the idea of like, you can make anything because these people are sitting at home on their chairs, like that android on the cover of the album. Like, that is almost like the birth of the Autechre we now know and love. Now, there's a slightly related comment from listener Joe, who says, this brings me to the last point I want to make. Why in the world do so many people wish that Autechre had only stuck to making their pre-chiastic style of music? I understand that there's lots of people who don't enjoy the more experimental stuff that came later, but the AI series is a reminder of just how much amazing music there is out there from this sound and era. These 8 releases only being a small slice of it. How much more do we need? How many more variations on these sounds and rhythms and song constructions before it finally gets stale? It's fine if this is the one style of IDM you really love, but don't bemoan Autechre continuing to push ahead and find new horizons. Yeah, what do you think about that? It kind of does show you, like, if you do like this era, maybe nothing is like as good, I would sort of agree with this, as early Autechre, you know, from this era, but there is so much to discover.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Joe here. You know, it annoys me when people, you know, it's the same thing. You know, Bob Dylan goes electric, people get pissed off. If you don't want the new experimental stuff, I understand if you don't like, you know, that sort of music. But fine, those old records still exist. You could still listen to them.
And there are a bunch of old records you've never heard
before.
Yeah,
exactly.
They remain undiscovered to you. And this series, I think Joe's exactly right, is like testament to that. Like, listen to these artists' discographies. I bet you'll find a bunch of stuff you love.
Exactly. I mean, there's plenty of styles of music that I've loved for, you know, 10, 20 years, and I'm still finding, new record. You know, I find new jazz records I love, weekly. I find new, you know, krautrock records I like, you know, all the time and stuff. The internet has like made this so, you know, I get like in the 90s, okay, it was probably a lot harder to find, find this.
Probably annoying.
Especially, you know, when Odd Tucker wasn't just giving you a new one every year and you had to go, you know, dig in some crates. Like, okay, that was probably a little bit of a hassle. But now, like, literally just go on Rate Your Music, open up the chart, and you know, look at best IDM records or best, you know, acid techno or whatever. And, I mean, you can even click, like, don't show me the ones I've already rated. And then you'll find literally endless amounts of any music style. It really does, like, annoy me when people... It's more annoying to be... Like, do you want Odd Tucker to be AC/DC and just release the same goddamn album over and over and over again for 40, 50 years? Like, that's garbage, and that ruins the reputation of the band and stuff. I think, you know, you're plenty allowed to say, you know, NTS not for me, LSEC not for me, but it's stupid to not want like an artist to, you know, push forward.
Yeah, agreed. Well, listener Joe also shared his rankings of every album in the AI series, which has AI 1 at number 1, Polygon Window at number 2, Incunabula at number 3, Ginger at number 4, Dimension Intrusion at number 5, Electrosoma at number 6, AI 2 at number 7, and Bites at number 8. He adds, "This pains me." We don't need to come up with our exact rankings, but any thoughts on which albums, you know, might be your favorites, maybe which ones might be your least favorites?
I think Incunabula is definitely my favorite, which not a big surprise, you know, doing an Odd Tucker podcast. But I mean, I think outside of that, Bites is probably my favorite. My least favorite is probably Electrosoma from B12. That one was just sort of okay. Well, I guess AI2 is probably my actual least favorite, but outside of the compilations, I think Electrosoma was just sort of the most okay and didn't leave that much of an impact on me. Like I said, I was glad to, you know, sort of find Dimension Intrusion. I think that's a record I'll, you know, put into rotation for a while. Ginger, I liked a lot. I wish it was on Spotify. It would get in the rotation a little more if it was, honestly. You know, Surfing on Sine Waves, that's one, you know, I hadn't looked at in a while. It was nice to revisit, you know, an old friend. I probably will put it back in the pile and not come to it again for a while. But it was definitely fun going through all these records.
Yeah, I think for me, I would just say like Incunabula is probably my favorite, but I might like Bites as much as Incunabula. I don't even know if I can pick between the two. I just think they are two like just masterpieces of you know, early electronic music. The others are, you know, not, I think, masterpieces, but just like absolute gems. I think I'd agree with you that like AI2 is the only one that I just have no interest in like, probably ever listening to again, outside of like those one or two like really fantastic tracks that are buried on that 75 minute monster. But you know, just overall, I think, you know, you've already sort of said it, and I was talking about it earlier, but just like such a strong series, like an incredible run. The fact that all these came out in 1993. In fact, I'm sort of stepping on the next question. You want to, again, from listener Joe, you want to read that one?
He says, it's interesting to point out that all six of the studio albums in this series were released in 1993, while AI1 was released in mid-1992 and AI2 in mid-1994. In fact, some of the albums were released within just weeks of each other. There's actually kind of a weird weird symmetry going on here. You have RDJ all by himself in January, then two albums in March, two albums in June, and then AE all by themselves in November. Do you think there's any logic to the way the albums and compilations were released, or do you think it all just came down to things like production capacity, schedule of other releases, etc., and this is just how it happened to shake out?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say that there's any logic, although, you know, we talked before about how, despite not liking AI2 that much, it's really cool that the series is bookended by two compilations. Mm-hmm. I also do kind of like, and this might just be my bias showing, but that, like, the last proper album in the series is Autechre, who are the kings of this, in my opinion, and it just sort of all leads to them.
Yeah.
I'm sure nobody thought of it that way at the time, but that's how it feels to me. You know, honestly, I just feel like it's just important, I think, to sort of stop and realize that this all came out like in essentially the same year, and it just kind of gets at like Warp's original intentions. You know, we talk about how the first AI compilation is all like, yeah, this is a new kind of music, you know, this is music for home listening, and it kind of walks the line a little bit, but it still has this almost punk spirit to it where it's like, this is different, you know, this is going to change the world. And the way they do it is by just blitzing their listeners with classic after classic after mm-hmm. classic. Like, that's how you cement that, right? We kind of put all of the like accomplishment on AI1, but it's actually this stretch that drives it home. It's like, electronic music will never be the same. That's just kind of how I feel when I reflect on like how fast all this happened.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, I think it would have been like amazing to see this happen, you know, in real time, you know, back then, because you're right. I mean, you know, that compilation comes out and it's easy to give it the credit, but yeah, I think if just that came out and, you know, nothing else really happened, I don't think it would have changed things, you know, in the electronic music world or anything. You know, it took this blitz of classics, masterpieces, you know, just good records, you know, back to back to show, you know, we're serious about this. And you know, we're going to do it. We in fact have done it, and here you go.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I could just imagine like living in like 1993 and like having heard AI1 and be like, this is really cool, but then having heard all the albums that came out in 93 and being like, okay, I'm never listening to anything else again, like, this is my
yeah,
life now.
Exactly.
But all right, now listener Mitchell wrote in a while ago to alert us to the fact that Warp released a video album with tracks synced to computer animation, Mind's Eye style. And listener Ella also wrote in with more context, saying it's worth noting that Artificial Intelligence 2 had a limited box release in Japan that included a VHS entitled Motion, with parentheses around it, containing several 3D animated music videos for some of the tracks on the compilation, as well as Polygon Window and Bass Cadet Mix. The videos are very 90s CGI and also weird as fuck. I think the whole "were they on drugs" saying is overused, but I can't think of another explanation for why there's a scene of two buildings fucking, for example. My favorite video of the set, and I may be biased, is the Autechre one. It's still really weird, but it has more of a structure and makes slightly more sense than the rest of the videos. I had never heard of this before myself, and I'll put a link in the show notes of this episode for anybody who's in the same boat. But did you get a chance to check it out, Dan, and what did you think?
Yeah, I did. Well, it starts out with that, you know, the scene on the cover of AI1 with the robot, but then he's smoking a jazz cigarette, which was hilarious. And it's like hilarious 90s CGI like way, which I think like really allows you to say they were on drugs making this. It probably would have been a lot cooler in the 90s. You know how I was talking about in the last episode how the cover reminded me of that like TV show, which I still don't look up. I think it's called Reboot.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is just a whole video of that. You know, I didn't watch the whole 45 minutes because it's a little dated and hard to. But you know, I skipped around, and in skipping around, several times there was. Like sperm, which was unnecessary on my part, but I mean, it's definitely a cool little relic of the past. I had never heard of it before getting these emails. As for the Autechre part, that was kind of cool. It's like this weird bug like going around, but then there's like a television chasing it or something. I don't know. It reminded me, I forgot to give my cats their flea medicine, which was nice of it, you know.
Yeah, useful. Yeah, it's a little like corny, to be fair. It's just like, yeah. You know, it's like super surreal, but then you kind of like make that corny by showing the android like smoking a joint, like you said.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like as if he's just transported to different, you know, there's like some weird like almost desert like Egyptian looking stuff going on, and yeah, bugs and sperm and just like other kind of surreal, you know, just really crude CGI stuff. You know, it kind of like goes to what we were saying the last episode about like how part of what the cover does is sort of teaches you how to listen to this new kind of music, like making it more familiar. Like, hey, it's like a Pink Floyd record, or like you should be sitting in a comfortable chair. You know, it kind of like familiarizes you with something that would otherwise be maybe a little unfamiliar mm-hmm. to people who are used to like going to the raves and stuff. And like, this isn't going to sound like that. So it just kind of adds to that, but it almost like makes it a little cornier than I would have liked. But yeah, an interesting relic all the same. So lastly, someone who goes by Wolf Desk left a YouTube comment on our AI episode that provides some important nuance on our discussion of the cultural context of that release. You want to read the abridged version real quick, Dan?
Sure. Wolf Desk writes, I think Sean's comments were very much aimed at the European rave output of the time, which was increasingly disposable and chart-oriented. I think that looking back with a contemporary mindset and assuming that techno started in Detroit, so Sean is speaking against that, is incorrect and drawing a very crude line between huge pivotal moments in the progression of electronic music. Every artist on that album was a big fan of the great Detroit producers and originators of techno, and it was definitely a reaction against the UK rave scene, as it had become a very commercial and cartoonish by 1992. There was definitely a movement in the UK toward the more futuristic sonic palettes of Detroit and away from Hoover breakbeat rave. Aphex and Richie Hawtin were both producing very rave-oriented stuff prior to this album, and we're both on a progression toward more diverse sonic palettes.
Yeah, so this listener, you know, I sort of cut a lot out because it was kind of a long comment, but this listener mentions like being the kind of person who was going to raves and did hear, you know, buy this album when it first came out in the UK at this time. You know, so they probably know more than us and are probably right, and it's interesting to think that like maybe they weren't trying to diss like techno's origins or something. You know, we talked about Sean's comments, how he's very much like, oh, music sucks and we're going to fix it. You know, that's like kind of brash, like 18, 19 year old kind of thing to say. So maybe they were actually saying music's gotten bad and we want to take it back to the like sort of futurist, like inventiveness of Detroit techno. But I don't know. I just find it like it's a little confusing to me because why not just say that then? You know, it's like basically what you have. And we talked about like Sean's comments in 2016, for example, like everybody walking this back being like, hey, it wasn't any value judgment on dance music. You know, no, we weren't taking any shots or anything like that. But like if music had become what this person is describing, then why not say music sucked? Like I'm not talking about Detroit techno. I'm talking about like this other kind of music that genuinely sucked. Like, why would that be so hard to say? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, it would, if in their walking it back, it would be super easy to walk it back and say, oh, I meant like this. I meant this, yeah, this specific,
yeah,
scene.
I wasn't talking about.
I love this. Yeah, this other thing. Yeah, I agree. You know, that listener does seem like he knows more than I do about it. But yeah, I mean, it does definitely seem like it's not entirely. You know, that again, you, yeah, know, Sean was 18, 19, whatever, when he said that. You know, it's not uncommon to, you know, say stupid stuff and have some, you know, bravado and stuff at that age. I don't think he was like, you know, intentionally, you know, being racist or something, you know, like don't get us wrong. I just think like it is sort of, you know, it comes off as a bit reductive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think he like really wanted to sort of take over the world. And I think this whole kind of group, this warp group was like, let's radically change like electronic music. And so, you know, maybe it was partially the press or whatever that kind of construed that as like them taking shots at all, yeah, previous dance music. But I think the point is they actually were trying to depart from previous dance music. Because again, it wouldn't be hard to say, yeah, there was a certain kind of music that was trendy at the time. It was super commercial and cartoonish and it sucked and it still sucks. I just highly doubt that Sean has like warmed to the kind of stuff that this person is describing. Then I started to have like even a minor epiphany while thinking about this comment where it's like, maybe the term IDM isn't so bad. It just needs to be more inclusive. Like, we all mean this secretly. Like, we like intelligent dance music. We don't like stupid, cartoonish, commercial dance music. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, maybe there's some exceptions stuff, but it's like, what they should have said is IDM doesn't just include these white guys from Britain. It also includes the geniuses from the Detroit techno scene. It also includes these people, you know, doing house in Chicago. It also includes, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
all smart. That's genius. That's brilliant shit. You know, this is the home listening version of that. That's the only difference. But yeah, we don't like stupid, you know, electronic music. We like interesting, inventive, creative, brilliant electronic music. That's not so bad.
No, I mean, I think that would be great. I mean, because you could say, you know, Wendy Carlos, that's intelligent electronic music, you know, but that stuff I was talking about in the last episode that, you know, was on those compilation CDs, you'd see it 12 o'clock at night, you know, on TV. That's stupid electronic music, you know.
Yeah.
It is easy to delineate what you actually mean.
Yeah, I feel like we could reclaim the term. We could just say like it just includes a lot more music than what was previously thought. Okay, actual last thing, because I saw this just a minute before we were about to start recording and added it to our outline. Listener Atlas wrote in to say, I want to go against the grain and say that I believe AI2 is better than AI1. While both records have great tracks, I feel like the second compilation has a cooler atmosphere and a more sophisticated sound. Arcadian, Symmetry, RealityNet, and Maritime are favorites. RealityNet in particular stands out from a composition standpoint because the rhythm of the track is really unique and funky, despite being rather minimal. There's a great selection here, and I can't say the track lengths really bothered me all that much, aside from the initial couple weaker tracks. I really just wanted to read this because we didn't get to hear from anybody, honestly, who prefers AI2 to AI1 on our actual episode. So this confirms that it's got its fans, and I think that's great to hear, even though, you know, I can't personally agree, but it's cool to note. Now, I just want to mention that we got other emails on other AE-related topics, but I wanted to keep this whole bonus episode kind of artificial intelligence focused, so we'll hold on to those for next time, all right? Fear not.
All right, if you got any Autechre opinions, hot takes you want to share, we want to hear them. Send them in, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. Next episode in a week, early guest com. Again, send us your thoughts on all that, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out by subscribing. Leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Look us up on YouTube, stay connected, Twitter, Instagram. Those are @gauntcastpod, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.